This is Autoline After Hours with John McElroy and Gary Vasilash, episode 427 for July 13th of 2018, The Last Panhard and the Genesis of Genesis. Watch Autoline After Hours live at autoline.tv every Thursday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time. That's 12 p.m. Pacific. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for Autoline in iTunes, Stitcher, or YouTube.
Autoline After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion, and by Lear, a global leader in automotive seating and electrical systems.
Time for Autoline After Hours.
It is.
Gary, how you doing?
Good. You know, I have one of these calendars at work that say things that happened on a given day.
What happened on this given day?
In 1962, the Rolling Stones had their first concert. So for all of our music-loving fans out there.
First anywhere?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
And for the audience to know, that,
that quizzical mind is
you just heard was Paul Eisenstein from the DetroitBureau.com. Great to have you on the show,
Great to
Paul.
Be here again.
Yeah. And our special guest today is Ken Nelson. And people remember he was on the show, last year sometime, right?
Something like that, yeah.
Yeah, and you brought which Panhard then?
That was their last model, a 24BT.
Yeah, very sleek, very aerodynamic-looking car. But you're back on the show, and you brought this really wild Panhard. And I say Panhard. I know it's properly pronounced Panhard. And I say Dina, but it was probably... Dina.
I don't even try to copy the French.
Dina?
Dina. Someone's in the kitchen with Dina. Right. So when I first look at this car, it reminds me of a Renault Dauphine. So they must have stolen the styling. Renault must have stolen the styling from Panhard.
Well, this body style came out in 1954, so I think that preceded, or maybe it didn't, the Dauphine?
No, it preceded the Dauphine probably by almost a decade.
Okay, because before they had the 4CV, before the Dauphine.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm.
Yeah.
I'm totally confused by one thing on this vehicle. I wish I had a little more time with it before we got on the air. What is that button, if that's what it is, between the two doors? I don't know.
Sticking out of the B-pillar.
Yeah.
That is the parking light that the French stick on all of their cars because they're too cheap to put street lights on in Paris. So you turn on the light from the dash on the side-facing traffic.
Hmm.
So if you get on a Paris street at night, at least back then, you'd see a line of lights.
You're talking about the little light on that little, the B pillar.
Yes, exactly.
I'll be darned.
Yeah, it's white in the front, red in the back, and every French car had one of those.
Huh. Okay, so I've got to ask. So post-war, there was lots of aluminum left over because they weren't building airplanes, and Panhard said, this would be good material to use to build cars, and that the original Dyna Z1 was aluminum. Is this car aluminum?
No, that's they switched from aluminum to steel somewhere in 55, 56. I've got two aluminum, all aluminum Panhard Z1s.
Mm-hmm.
One is out of the Reynolds aluminum collection.
Huh.
When they were bought out by Alco or Alcan, they put it up for auction, and roundabout way, I ended up with it.
Mm-hmm. So why did they give up on aluminum back then?
Three times the price.
Good reason.
They were having their bodies built by a separate French company, and nobody was paying attention to the price. Kind of hard to believe, but they were going into bankruptcy.
So give us a picture of this overall car. We've got, a four-door sedan.
Right.
But you take it from there, because there's some really wild things about this car from an engineering standpoint.
Well, this is the second generation of cars they brought out after World War II. They designed this flat twin hemispherical head.
Flat twin. So two-cylinder, flat boxer.
Right.
Air-cooled.
Front-wheel drive powertrain. In 1946, after the war, it's an all-roller bearing engine, and the Conrod engine, or the Conrod bearing, is actually a very strange roller bearing designed by Leonardo in 1480.
Huh. What? Yeah, as in Da Vinci.
Yes. In Leonardo da Vinci designed that. I saw his sketch in the Loire Valley of France in 2005 and just about fell over. He's credited, Wikipedia gives him credit for inventing the ball bearing. And the roller bearing was just as easy.
So you've got this all-roller bearing engine. Right. When you say all-roller bearing...
Crankshaft, Conrod.
Okay.
All those bearings. So the friction level is way down versus standard shell bearings, and this thing loves to rev. It was designed to rev at 7,000 RPM.
Wow.
In 46.
And one of the... How much does it put out in horsepower and torque?
This 850cc engine, which was their standard 40 horse.
Which is a lot of horsepower.
Especially back then.
That displacement.
Compared to a VW four-banger at what, 30 horse, 32?
Yeah.
Yeah.
How much... Is there any validity to the technology in this engine to today? What would be... Where would this show up?
Okay. When did we go to roller lifters? This car had roller lifters in 1954. It also had hydraulically adjusted valves about 54 also, but not in the lifters. The French went for super low reciprocating mass. So the roller lifters weren't hydraulic. They adjusted the rocker arm hydraulically. It's floated on a hemispherical ball, knuckle, that's floated by oil pressure.
Wow.
For zero lash. And the output was so high and the RPM so good in 1946, they couldn't use coil springs. They fatigue failed very quickly. So it's operated by torsion bars.
Torsion bar...
Valves.
Valves.
Yes. Torsion bar closed valves. One inside, another hollow one. So one valve is operated by a shaft, the other by a torsional tube. And they're actually interlocked, splined at one end, so that when one valve opens, it pulls the other tighter shut. It's almost desmodromic.
Hmm. What vehicle was it being used in 46?
The original Panhards that they built after the war. Before the war, they built big six-cylinder Dynamiques with sleeve valve engines for the rich. After the war, they were basically told, as I understand it, to come up with an economy car.
If I remember correctly, the French government after the war told every automaker precisely what and where they could build, and they assigned them specific segments of the market.
That seems to be correct, yeah.
Yeah.
And so they ended up with an economy car, but they know the French like to drive fast. They'd had no oil supply, so they went for super efficient, powerful engines, and this is what they got.
So give us some performance, maybe not specs, but what can this car do?
The basic sedan like this, basically 5 to 6 passenger, 4-door, with a 40-horse engine, this will cruise at 85 to 90 miles an hour.
Hmm.
And I've done it. I was clocked at going 85 up I-23 after one of the orphan car shows locally by a friend and following in his Chrysler. And it wasn't flat out.
It's good it wasn't the state police clocking you at 85.
Yeah, correct. With the very first ones of this model in 54 with the all-aluminum body, I'm sure they might even have been a little faster because the entire body shell back then weighed 220 pounds.
Which is That's amazingly
wow.
light.
Yeah, right. And I was told when I first came out of the auto industry, you can't weld aluminum. Well, wait a minute. They were doing it for the whole car in 1954. The engine is, again, very light. The transaxle, it's a 4-speed front-wheel drive transaxle with a double reduction gear to the differential. I'm assuming for compactness, you can pick up the entire transaxle with one hand. It's that light.
Hey, Wright Knight, somebody wrote in to say, that car needs a Hemi.
It's got a Hemi. It's been a Hemi since day one.
He goes on to say, that car having a Hemi would bring a whole new meaning to the term Panhard rod.
Well, the fact is, they invented the Panhard rod term. Panhard is credited with laying out the basic front engine, rear drive of all of the cars that followed.
And that was what, back in the 30s or before?
Try 1891.
Oh.
Yes. They were the very first car company in the world. They started in 1890. They even go back further than that. They were building engines under license from Daimler starting in 1876.
Wow.
For probably stationary power sources.
Wow.
Sawmills, whatever, pumps. And... being a cart manufacturer, they stuck an engine in a cart. And the Panhard rod was developed to locate the rear axle. And
we still use them today.
And the hot rodders don't know where the hell it came from. Pardon my French.
Yeah.
So
literally your French.
Yes.
Yeah, so if you think about it, 1891 cars basically had engines under the seats or in the back of the vehicle.
Right.
And nobody had it in the front.
Right.
And these guys just, and so the architecture that we're familiar with, like this car, goes back to those guys.
That's funny.
And there's pretty cool.
Been some rumors that they might have even have invented the circular steering wheel versus the tiller. But I don't know for that.
So, Ken, how did you come by this car?
I was part, of the Chrysler CCV program started, when was it, about 1991,
maybe?
Yeah. Somewhere around
there. So CCV, we should say, was the China concept vehicle.
Right.
Chrysler was trying to...
There were two versions of it. The first was the China concept. Then they just changed it to CCV.
Right.
And dropped the name China. Because they didn't think there was a market in China for cars, well, totally accurate forecast.
A simple car that could be put together very easily.
Right. And I always thought the DeChavot was the inspiration.
It was, because the whole idea was François Castaing's brainchild. He was Frenchman. He came in with AMC when Chrysler bought him. He grew up in a DeChavot, going to school in France, and they were looking for a super cheap car, and the real concept was to keep the car cost low, they would eliminate paint by using a plastic body with molded in color.
In fact, Carmen, you just had the picture up. Bring it back up, because I think we all missed that.
What's funny, by the way, if you look at it...
Look at that thing.
In many ways, that's very similar to what Tata tried to do in
with
India.
The Nano. Right.
With a Nano.
And today's the last day of the Nano.
Really?
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, it's done.
First concert for the Rolling Stones, last day of the Nano.
Man.
Wow.
What a day.
It is.
How many of them have caught
fire? Look at that. I think that thing looks pretty cool. And it does look, I mean, obviously it was inspired by the DeChavot. You especially see that in the C-pillar there.
Well, and then also if you look at the top is basically...
It's fabric.
Fabric top.
Well, what about some of the Japanese cars that were actually styled sort of like that later on?
It looks a little bit like the S-Cargo, if you remember that.
Nissan, right.
Yeah.
But those body panels weren't stamped. They were injection molded.
Yeah.
Well, that was the concept. Those are fiberglass. It's a mock-up.
But the plan was that this was how they'd manufacture it, and so it would be
just... Had a rough finish, if I remember correctly.
And even the interior was basically a molded piece that would be inserted.
Gary, you know this. It was essentially two pieces. The entire body was two pieces, right? Like, sliced horizontally down.
And so they had...
vertically down the center of the car.
So there was a manufacturer that they had built, because I went out to the west side of the state. Was Cascade Engineering, I think the name of the company was.
Yes,
And
Husky,
Cascade was basically one of the things they did was make out of plastic giant trash containers.
Yes.
And because they had a press that was big enough to make the panels of the car, then they tried them out there. It was a fascinating thing, and it's and it had a very small engine as well, as I recall.
It was two-cylinder.
It was a two-cycle.
No, it was a Briggs & Stratton.
Oh, really?
Yeah. It was a lawnmower engine.
With a Subaru transaxle, if I remember. Well, when they got they started with a 57 2CV they bought from some restorer on the East Coast, brought it in, tore it down, studied the thing down at the New Liberty Center, and it was about 6 months into the program when I came in one day, and there was a Spinard that was beige at the time.
This one?
Yeah.
The Dyna Z16.
Right. But Castaing's overall idea was... You took the elements of the DeChavot, you learned what they did from that, and translated it to a plastic body, that sort of thing.
Huh.
And that would give them twice the cylinders as their lawn tractor, which he thought the Chinese used for their basic transportation. And Castaing had this idea of the model kit car that was a top and a bottom shell or sideways, however you did it, to minimize the cost. I told him, why didn't they buy the 2CV tooling? It was available. And any Chinese person could fix a bicycle. And it's a tube structure inside the 2CV almost. You build that, and he'd use a DuPont snap-on fascia material with molding and color. Nah, they didn't like that idea.
Yeah, that was too easy.
Right.
Now, does this car have the tubular subframes?
No, this is all Monaco. Oh, you mean the front? Huge?
Yeah.
Yes. This has an 8-inch cross tube
that bolts to
the bottom. Yes.
Really?
Bolts to the bottom of each sill at the front. 3 bolts per side. You undo those, the entire front end comes off.
Wow.
Powertrain, everything, and the wheel liners unbolt from the firewall. And the hood's one piece.
Okay, so let's go back to the story. You go into the New Liberty operation,
right,
which was sort of Chrysler's skunk works.
Yes.
And they're working on this China concept vehicle, CCV, right, and you see this Panhard there.
Right.
How did that come about?
Well, I went over and asked the fellow working on it. I said, do you know anything about this? And he said, hell no. Pardon my French again.
It's a French car.
That's true. But in doing some research, when it came up for sale, which was years later, I was out at the Orphan Car Show with Pete Dawson, a friend from Chrysler, and Ken Mack.
Also from Chrysler.
Yes. And Ken mentioned that they were closing down the program and selling off the Duchevaux and this Panhard.
Ah.
And it turns out Bob Lutz had found this car somewhere on the East Coast. In fact, at an engineering company, I've got some paperwork here, that was Northumberland Engineering. And the fellow there, evidently someone had bought it, and they brought it in, whether it was a personal car or whatever. Bob somehow came across it and bought it, brought it into the program, because similar idea, two-cylinder, small car, light car, high fuel economy. And there's also a paper I got here along with the car, which shows an article from, it doesn't say what magazine, but it has an advertisement for a Mahari, a Citroen Mahari, which is basically a plastic 2CV.
Wow.
And Bob Lutz wrote a note about this saying, Messrs. Gates, somebody or other, if we want one, there are two available. They were interesting. A 2CV frame and mechanicals, all plastic molded body, Bob Lutz. So there it is.
Okay, Miradart just wrote in to say, the bumpers have a sheen. They don't shine like actual chrome. Are they aluminum?
They are all aluminum. Most cars, at least a lot of French cars, always used either aluminum or stainless trim, which is great. No rusty bumpers. And the lightweight, of course. And there's a picture here of that car taken back in December of... looks like 2011. And I think I showed it to Bob at another Orphan Car Show or someplace. And
yeah,
we
had that picture up on the screen.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, it's funny when you see the front shot of it, it looks like it's blowing you a kiss. Mm-hmm.
I just switched the front end piece to this headlight, which was an option in France. Prior to that, it was sticking its tongue out at you. Mm-hmm. Always reminded me of people getting the raspberries from a car.
So was it always just a France market car, or did it have sales elsewhere?
They actually sold them in the U.S. because Citroën bought them somewhere around 64 and imported them to their dealers, but it didn't last long. And because Citroën folded in 72 in the U.S. because of bumper standards and so on.
Yeah.
One story I heard was they had a shipment of 200 of these at the docks in New York.
With the tongue out.
Yeah, there's the tongue. When Citroën shut down Panhard, and there were these abandoned brand-new cars at the docks in New York. Some guy bought them. He bought 10 of them for $200 a piece, brand-new.
Oh.
Yeah.
Do they still own the name? Is it still a viable name if they, for some reason, PSA wanted to do something with
they
it?
They now build military vehicles.
Panhard.
Right. Right. In fact, I almost got a job working on a Panhard tank for a California billionaire who had the world's largest collection of military vehicles. It had 6 engines arranged flat, bolted end-to-end underneath the floor.
6.
It was a flat 12.
You know, it's interesting, for the company Panhard, this basically caused their demise.
Yes. They were always bankrupt, it seemed, or so close to the edge that... But I learned something from various people in the club saying that In fact, a personal friend I've known for 50 years drove one. He's a Frenchman, 100 miles an hour, but he said the engines only lasted until about 30,000 miles because of tetraethyl lead in the gas, which plugged up the oil galleries. The crank has a sludge trap at the end, which is an oil catch ring for the oil squirted by the camshaft to get to the roller bearings in the conrod. You can't put oil pressure through a roller bearing because it's open. So this catch ring would catch oil from the camshaft and centrifuge it into the bearing. And I've got crankshafts I've pulled out of engines and found that ring full of sludge, which plugs the hole. So they'd burn out the bearings with the sludge in 30,000 miles. And I used to find that same sludge in my early, late 50s Citroen engines with no oil filters. And these don't have it either. Mm-hmm. So the tetraethyl lead...
No, which, oil filter.
No, just a screen on the pump. That's all. A lot of American cars didn't have oil filters till the 50s. Quite a few of them.
I didn't realize.
In fact, some had splash lubrication going back a while. But that lead, which you only needed to save the valve seats that were machined into iron heads... That lead would coat the seats and prevent wear of the valve seat, recession of it. The European engines with aluminum heads had hardened valve seats. You didn't need it. But they got stuck with the tetraethyl lead. Hmm.
So you mentioned the aluminum head. Does it have an aluminum block as well?
Yes, it's an aluminum. It's a one-piece fin and head. There is no separate head with a shrunk-in steel liner and an aluminum crankcase that is one piece. It's not split. You've got to tuck the pistons and rods, or rather, you got to put the crank in without the pistons and just the rods tucked in between the webs through an oval hole in the back, and then pull it out and attach the pistons and the cylinders. Not exactly the easiest.
We'll let you do that.
Yeah. No thanks.
Caraga One writes in to say that car also needs Lamborghini doors.
Well, it's got suicide doors. What else do you want?
No, those aren't suicide. Oh, the front doors are suicide.
Front doors are suicide.
Oh, my God.
Front door.
They were suicide until about 1963 or 62, because I have a later model brake that's a 63 with normal doors, which I prefer.
This is an odd collection you have.
Yes.
Caraga also wants to know, where's the baguette holder on the car?
The baguette?
Says, just kidding. Yeah.
Well, actually... You could stick a wine bottle into the door pocket.
Yeah, I think that's a design requirement of all French cars, even to this day.
And lots of hashtags. Yes.
So why did they have suicide doors in the front and not in the back?
You got me. The French Traction Avant, which was started production in 35, also had suicide doors. And how many American cars had suicide doors back then? Some. Mm-hmm. I don't know why. I've never liked them. They're a nuisance, as far as I'm concerned. But
and there, everybody can see we've opened one of the doors there, the driver's door.
Right.
Look how wide and open that is. It's so easy to get in.
I would imagine that when you had your evening gown on, I mean, if it were on the other side, you'd be able to get in more readily, at least in the front. But in the back, it would just be...
Normal.
Do you wear yours normally when you get in?
Often. Yeah. Only when I'm in vintage French cars.
Yeah.
There you go. with the vintage French woman.
Yeah. Yes. I just wish, vintage French wine.
Yes.
You know, it's great that we've got video here. I just wish the internet could convey scent as well, because I wish people could smell this car. It's just got that classic old car smell to it.
Right.
And so... The wheel covers are rather interesting. They almost look like spun aluminum.
They are. Yeah, they...
Spun aluminum, really.
They have a plastic insert that snaps in, but the plastic never lasts that long. Mm-hmm. But, again, aluminum hubcaps, as much aluminum as you'd ever want to keep the weight down. Mm-hmm. And no corrosion there.
Right.
Mm. Wow, real interesting. What else are we missing? We're coming to the end of the segment. What else should we know about this car, Ken?
Well, just that it's nice and that I can keep up with traffic. I don't worry about traffic. I can run any freeway around here and do 80 miles an hour in the car.
With an 850cc engine.
Right.
And what's the transmission again?
It's a four-speed on the column, front-wheel drive with a miniature crown gear about that big that drives a bull gear with a differential in it. Why they did that, I don't know. Something about engine centerline versus transaxle or whatever. Nobody else ever does it. Of course, the French never do anything like anyone else does.
Yeah.
So, but it's just, I like the idea of being able to thumb my nose both at the oil companies and the V8s.
Oh, that raises one important question. How much fuel economy do you get?
40 miles per gallon.
Wow. No kidding.
40?
40 miles per gallon.
On a 19 what?
50, it goes back to 46, that engine basically.
See, just imagine were that to be an all-aluminum car as it originally was designed as.
Right.
What sort of fuel economy would you have gotten then?
Well, I would love to stick a mega squirt system on this car and set it up for fuel injection. And in my all-aluminum one, who knows, 50, 60 miles per gallon and 100 miles an hour?
That's awesome.
Wow.
Yeah, if it could be upgraded with modern technology, what do you think? Didn't Fiat start out with a tiny two-cylinder a few years back? Weren't they trying to commercialize something that was really radical?
Chrysler did.
I know they worked on a two-stroke, right.
The Orbital.
But I thought there was another program out of Europe where they were designing a very fuel-efficient two-cylinder car.
Yeah, I don't remember that. Albert Maniscalco writes in to say, French cars are quirky, innovative, and underrated.
Absolutely. Absolutely. What?
How many French cars do you own?
You don't want to know.
I'll have you know, my mom owned a Citroen DS back in 1959. And you got a sense of how quirky it was one day, because back then you could play stickball in the street, and you always put the worst player on the sidelines to watch for traffic, right? And he'd have to shout out car, and everybody would run to the side. And there my mother's car came up the street on three tires. She had blown the fourth one, and it was just flopping in the air because of the hydraulic suspension system. Mm-hmm. Now, the downside was it took her 6 weeks to get this strange sort of tire called a radial. Nobody heard about those back then.
Well, my father started this whole mess with a 58 DS19 in 1962.
Mm-hmm.
In Salt Lake City, middle of nowhere back then.
Hassler, New Jersey wasn't much better.
Right. And so it had oddball-sized tires, 400 millimeters, which were 15 to 3/4 inch. Come on, that's not standard.
That's French.
But and the early DSs were the most complex they ever made. But that was his car to go up to Montana to fly fish for trout. And he always got home. Somehow we survived.
Mad Surgeon wrote in, I think he missed the first part of the show, but he asked, did Panhard succeed to invent the Panhard bar that we see on the rear ends of cars that use coil springs?
Bingo.
Yeah, yep. That was it. And you said 1890 what? They came up with the Panhard rod?
They actually started building the cars in 1890. By 91, they'd made 26 cars.
Unreal.
Now, where exactly the Panhard rod came along that timeline, I don't know, but by 1891 they built 26 cars and sold a bunch of engines to Peugeot.
Real good. Well, we're going to have to wrap this up, but Ken, thanks so much for coming back on the show and bringing this Panhard. This is just fantastic having these very unusual vehicles in the car and knowing that they are really engineering masterpieces.
They are. I've learned more from them than about anything else I've done.
Real good. Well, thanks again for being here. We're going to take a quick commercial break, and we'll be back to talk about news in the automotive industry.
Lear Kinexus offers a parental controls application with geofencing that sends notifications regarding driving behavior and location, including curfew alerts, acceleration alerts, and speed alerts. All delivered to a smartphone application that includes vehicle location, driver notifications, and a report card of driving history, including notifications when predefined geographic boundaries are crossed. For more information, visit Lear.com.
All right, we're back. Cool car, huh?
It is, absolutely.
I'm just blown away by these vehicles that Ken's got. Mm-hmm. Unbelievable. And not just has, but really knows all the engineering that went into them.
And drives them.
And drives them. The best of all.
Yeah.
Exactly right.
If you're around long enough, you hear the term Panhard a lot, and you just think of it as somebody, maybe a supplier who invented all these little things.
Yeah, it's like McPherson strut or something, Panhard rod. I mean, it's just part of the automotive vocabulary.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Cool. Okay, well, this is part of the show where it's time for Dr. Data.
Okay, so this is a... So I thought we would change it up entirely.
Oh.
Change it up entirely, and so this is a seasonal question. This has to do with the season, okay?
Okay.
And so, Carmen, Katie, whomever, please bring the first thing up. 3,365 miles. What is 3,365 miles represent? And it has something to do
with the season. So this is, I'm tempted to say this is the average number of miles that somebody drives on their summer vacation, but that can't be right because
that's a good one.
Okay.
It's wrong, but it's a good one. Paul, what do you think that is?
Well, that would seem to be the number of miles the average person drives during the summer season.
That may be true, but that's not the right answer either.
Oh.
So bring up the correct answer. It is the length of Route US 20, the longest highway in the United States.
Oh, what?
And we'll see a map right here. And there it goes from Boston, Massachusetts to Newport, Oregon.
I'll be darned.
So I was thinking,
it's even longer than US 2.
It's the longest going. Yeah.
Wow.
See, so I was thinking, what do you do in the summer? You drive. See, as you guys were getting there, I started chasing down the whole notion of Route 66, but this just trumps everything.
Very interesting. Wow. Yeah. Nope. I never knew that.
So there you go. So, for your summer driving pleasure, Route 20, Paul.
That sounds
coast
good.
Coast to coast.
There's no beautiful song about it, though.
No, there isn't.
Get your kicks on Route 20.
Yeah, it doesn't work.
And the Rolling Stones did that song, by the way.
On Route 20.
Don't stretch it. Let's talk about news.
All right. Well, let's talk about one thing. So we just saw Boston, and the three of us were just north of Boston,
in Maine
this week, and we were with the folks from Genesis. And
in the beginning, there was Genesis.
Yes, that's right.
So
Hyundai's luxury brand.
Yeah, the company that they've created as a standalone, and we were there for the G70. But I think what's more interesting than that one car in terms of the context of what's going on is. Okay, here is a car company, essentially, right, that is starting now, that is not a Silicon Valley-based company that is building electric vehicles. It is a normal, regular car company, okay? So my question to you guys is what's its likelihood of success?
Knowing the Koreans and watching what they have done, over the last 10 years, their chance of success is strong, especially if they get to decide what the metrics are. And they seem to be decide what does it mean? What are they aiming for? If you look at it, here's a company that said, we're happy. We're going to drop the number of dealers and drop our sales significantly. So that means they have their own metrics, which may be very different from what other companies would allow.
See, I read it a little bit differently. I think they've blown the launch of this
you
brand.
Do.
Oh, yeah, big time. I mean, number one, in an SUV crossover world,
I agree with you
they've
there.
Come out with three sedans.
Right.
Their sales have been terrible. Now they're deliberately trying to reduce sales, like you said, because they're trying to clear out all the inventory on their dealer lots.
Right.
Why? Because these cars are sold at Hyundai dealerships. But as the president of Hyundai Motor America told me, you can't sell luxury Genesises, Genesi, next to Elantras. You can't do it.
Right. No.
And the reason they did that is, you know, to launch a brand is really hard. How do you get dealers to sign up when you haven't even shown any cars? So they decided, let's sell them in Hyundai dealerships. Now they realize that's not going to work.
Well, here's the interesting thing, because they are both the best and the worst. If you look, they just knocked it out of the park. highest score ever in J.D. Power,
right.
initial quality,
yeah.
and the lowest score when it came to sales satisfaction. So customers love the product,
the
and they love the
terrific.
Experience.
The cars are fantastic.
Are terrific, right? I was blown away by the G70.
You first, can't talk about it, Paul.
Yeah, yes, we you can.
It's under embargo.
You know, yeah, it's under
embargo.
You can
talk about
it. We can talk a little bit, but it's...
Sure you can.
We can a little bit.
Not driving impressions.
Right. But the bottom line is, they have done a great job in terms of quality, and they surprise everybody with what they offer for the money.
Mm-hmm.
But the problem is, to your point, John, you don't like walking into a Hyundai showroom because it's just not the luxury experience.
All right, so let me ask you guys this. If we go back some years and we walked into a Hyundai dealership, we could buy something called the Genesis Coupe. It was a successor to the Tiburon.
Right.
Right.
Right? And so there was a model that was called the Genesis. Now, that car was not an expensive car. It was sort of a boy racer car.
The coupe. The name was more.
But I mean, again, it was not above a Sonata.
No.
Okay. And so my question is did they make a mistake by naming the brand that is the luxury brand Genesis? Because here we are talking about going into a Hyundai dealer.
Well, we got a picture of the original Genesis Coupe.
Right. I mean, and it was a high performing car. I mean, it was.
Awareness is so low.
Of that car?
The Genesis name in general as an automotive product. I don't think it can hurt them.
Didn't have a problem?
No, I think they can get past that. The name is not a bad name. It's got a certain quality to it that I think they can bring about a strong awareness of it. And what I was intrigued by, Gary, you and I drove with Irwin Raphael, the head of the operation here in North America, and his position that they don't need a lot of brand awareness. They've cut their brand awareness, believe it or not. Brand awareness, what you people spend hundreds of millions of dollars for, was 6% last December. It's down to 3% as they sort of relaunch the brand. And to your point, John, yeah, it is essentially a relaunch.
But here's the problem I see with them, or the challenge. And I agree with what you said, Paul. The Koreans are so proud. Hyundai is such a proud company.
Right.
They will accept massive losses yeah. until they get this right.
How long has Infiniti been struggling to try to figure out what they are?
Mm-hmm.
1989, and Infiniti is just really now starting to deliver what you would have thought they should have delivered, say, by the early to mid-90s.
Yeah. But, you know, it's such a tough segment right now. You know, you've got the German premium brands and right. Lexus that, at least in the U.S., dominate the segment.
And new entries coming.
And you've got a resurgence of companies like Volvo, which is now moving upscale and soon going to have Polestar on top of that,
right.
all electric. You know, you got Cadillac trying to claw its way back. And now you've got Alfa Romeo coming back into yeah. the mix. And, man, it's going to be a long haul for Genesis to turn into a successful company.
But that's my point about metrics. What do they define as their success?
Mm-hmm.
And knowing Hyundai and watching what they have done, the fact that this company, with its three brands, has been able to go from the joke, I'd get a car, to be honest, I'd get a Hyundai or a Kia in the press fleet, and I'd make sure I had a second car because I only wanted to drive it a day or two. There wasn't much else you wanted to do with it, right? Now, you look at some of their products, and they're a joy to drive, they're good looking, and the quality is there. So if they've been able to transform the Hyundai and Kia brands as remarkably as they had, their biggest problem is the same as the Genesis brand has right now,
mm-hmm.
misreading the market and not having the right product at the right time.
Here's the other thing I'll say about Genesis that was very interesting. So the guy who runs the operation globally, Manfred Fitzgerald,
right.
came from Lamborghini.
Right.
You've got Luc Donkervalka, who had been
He was a star at the Volkswagen Group.
At Bentley.
And Audi.
And Audi, but I'm saying his last job was at Bentley.
Yeah.
Right.
And you've got Albert Bierman, who is, running BMW M?
Right.
You know?
And then you've got the head of styling for the entire group. So you've got a ton of European superstars.
So this is very interesting. You know, Infiniti has struggled, struggled, and struggled. Now they've got an American who's head of design, right. You know. Well, actually, he's been now promoted. He's head of design for Alfonso Albaiza, you know,
yeah.
Al-Nissan.
Albaiza, yeah.
And, but what I like and admire and respect about Hyundai is, and they're so proud, they want to be it all Korean, but they recognized, hey, this luxury thing, this is different. Let's go out and hire some of the best yeah. talent that we can get in the world.
Yeah.
And that's going to help them immensely.
Okay, so let me throw a little curve on this. That okay, so here we have them, you know, hiring a guy from Lamborghini, hiring a designer from Bentley, and hiring the head of BMW M to do their chassis engineering. What is the likelihood that a Chinese company would basically then do this very same thing and cherry-pick talent?
100%.
You think it's 100%?
100% that one of the Chinese companies will do as much or more than they've done.
They haven't done it yet. We've seen it happen in design. So, yeah. You know, Geely has gone out and got Peter Horbury, who had been at Ford and yeah, Volvo.
But they bought Volvo to get him.
But all of Volvo.
Right.
All of Volvo is basically their research lab for Geely.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So they have hired a ton of Europeans.
Well, yeah, no, I hear what you're saying. But they haven't brought them inside Geely proper. You know, mm-hmm. You know, Volvo is doing its thing in Sweden.
But they're stealing bits and pieces.
True.
Platforms will
right.
go over to
but
Geely.
That's not the same.
No, I get it. I get it.
Hyundai is doing, bringing in these guys yeah. to essentially run the operation.
Right.
Right. All right, so I want to move off
yeah.
that,
okay.
But okay, but this, so this I know, Paul, this will get you going. Speaking of Hyundai, so an AP story came out where basically the Hyundai Motor Labor Union mm-hmm. in Korea
yeah.
said that if the 25% auto tariffs go into effect and it hurts the sales of vehicles, that the way their contract is written, that overseas operations will get shut down before anybody would lose their job in South Korea. And this labor union in yeah. South Korea is indicating that this puts 20,000 workers at risk of layoff
in the
United States. At Montgomery, Alabama plant.
Yeah.
So then there's the issue of BMW Group, which has the massive plant in Spartanburg, where they're building all of their...
all their X models, basically. Most of their X models.
SUV models, basically, yeah. is saying that, you know, if there's this tariff that is going to be imposed, they're going to have to raise their prices, sending them to China by 40%, which could have an effect on whether you do a whole lot more manufacturing to send cars to what is... Obviously, BMW's now biggest market, right?
Yeah.
China.
Today, curious enough, if I can interrupt you for a second, I was surprised that BMW said they're going to move ahead with an investment plan for Spartanburg. But they still left open the possibility that further investment was supposed to be large.
Mm-hmm.
could be cut. And remember, Spartanburg is it's their largest factory, I believe, worldwide.
Mm-hmm.
And it is the largest export plant in the United
yeah,
States. One of the great ironies of the whole Trump strategy is that a number of car companies that have invested heavily in the United States and are the biggest exporters of automobiles from the United States would be hardest hit. So the odds are that if the tariff war takes hold, the U.S. automotive export market could be crushed.
Well, I want to know what you guys think. What's going to happen? I mean, so we're all anticipating that this year will be less robust than last year in terms of sales in the United States.
That's what we've thought. The market keeps getting stronger.
What drove June? How much of that was anticipatory? People have been told now for a month that you could be facing tariff hikes. And I don't know if there was something baked into the June numbers, people saying, you know what, I was going to get a car in August, but I think there may
be... I think we're hyper aware of all this tariff talk. I think the general public is not very aware of
it. I think this one is. It's in the news all the time.
But sales have been stronger all year long than anyone has expected. In fact, every single analyst, because I pay attention to what they're predicting, thought that June sales would be up on a total number basis, but down on a daily selling rate basis, because there was an extra day and an extra weekend thrown in. And in fact, the market blew through all the numbers. Yes.
Right. Yeah. But IHS
and the
is still
annualized rate
versus 17.2.
Yeah, I know, but it's...
You think it's not going to happen?
I think there's an underlying strength here that's driven by two things. The economy is very healthy and population growth. And I think this is an underlying thing that's been overlooked right now, because every year the population of the United States goes up by more than 2 million people. Generally speaking, about 5% of the population goes out and buys a new car every year.
Yeah.
That's another 100,000 people going into the market every year.
Here's a funny little addendum to that, John. The population has gone up in part because of immigration.
Yeah.
And
it's about half and half.
Right. Our birth rate is relatively low, and our immigration rate has been high. And immigrants make up a disproportionate share of car buyers. Hmm. So you cut immigration to the United States. First of all, despite all the images of people coming here, you know, illegally and going on welfare and everything, the good percentage of the population that's come from abroad, educated, reasonably affluent, buying cars, working, you know, bringing their education to work in Silicon Valley and so on. So they've been a plus to the economy and plus to automotive sales. And if we wind up closing the door on that, we hurt ourselves there too.
Okay. Let's not go down in the weeds here.
Yeah.
So bottom line here is, Paul, you think
it would get me worked up.
You think tariffs are going to have a deleterious effect on car sales?
They're already having an effect.
Already. And John, you think?
I'm going to play contrarian here, because I'm not in favor of raising the tariffs, but there's no question that this can work. And I point to the voluntary restraint agreement that the Reagan administration imposed, limiting the sales of Japanese cars, which forced them to build a bunch of plants in the U.S. When you look at under the Obama administration, the tariffs that they put on Chinese tires, we got 5 new tire plants in the United States out of that. If you turn things around and you say, it would be terrible to put a 25% import tariff on these vehicles. Well, that's what the Chinese do. And by the way, the Chinese say, if you want to build cars in our country, you have to split all the profits with your partner, because you have to get a partner. And by the way, you've got to give them all your technology, too.
Which, by the way, they just changed a bit. So BMW just went over 50%, first car maker to do that.
Yeah. Now they're easing off a little bit. And why? Because I think it's all these threats of Trump coming up with it.
I think it was more than that.
You know, Europe has 4x import tariff on American vehicles going there. And this has bugged me for a long time, that the United States has said, come on in, we have this very low tariff. And when we start talking about doing what they're doing to us, everybody comes unglued. And so I don't want to see us go down the tariff war route. What I do hope it does is everybody says, okay, knock off all the tariffs, just zero tariffs.
Which is what Volvo and a few other companies have been pushing for.
Well, so is Trump.
Yeah.
Administration. All I'm saying is, would it work? Let's assume the worst case. Let's say that we go through and we say, hey, look, we've had 25% import tariff on trucks. And by the way, would GM, Ford, and Chrysler even be around today if they didn't have these profitable pickups that were protected by these tariffs? I would argue they'd be gone. Mm-hmm. They'd be bought out by others, because they wouldn't have the profits to keep funding what's going on. And I'm not in favor of protectionism, but it could work. This is too big of a market for all these companies to walk away from.
I don't understand who's walking away, because Mercedes has a plant in Alabama. Hyundai has a plant in Alabama.
Yeah, but one plant can't build your whole line.
Well,
are you going to cut back on the lineup that you're going to have?
Certainly if they start finding they can't export, which is a major problem. I think a lot of the automotive exports are going to be hurt. A lot of auto workers are going to be hurt.
Exports will hurt if countries retaliate against
which they're
the
already
US.
Doing. China?
But China already charges 25%.
There's a lot of other ways that China will hurt, and it may not
I
be
automotive. I want to know what cars do they buy in China?
They buy more than you think. It was about 260,000 vehicles exported from the U.S. to China last year.
Yeah, there's a China.
It's more than you realize.
I want to say it's like number three on the export list. Number one is Canada, then Mexico, then China. Yeah.
And by the way, John, I don't particularly disagree with the basic concept of pushing to renegotiate some of the tariffs with trade partners.
What's wrong with reciprocity? You charge me 25%, I'll charge you 25%. You charge me 10, I'll charge you 10.
John, there's a very big difference between negotiating and doing what we saw this week.
All right, we were talking about Volvo earlier. Okay, Volvo came up a couple of times, and I thought this was very fascinating, that Volvo launched something called M, the letter M.
Yeah,
and it's a new brand that will be a mobility service.
Right.
And it sounds to me that basically this is a sort of an app-based thing, but you actually get a car. It isn't some guy's going to come drive over to your house and pick you up and drive you somewhere.
Right.
Okay. And so it's going to debut in Sweden and the United States in the spring of 2019. So it's coming up pretty quick. And so the president and CEO of Volvo, Håkan Samuelsson, said, "Volvo Cars is becoming more than just a car company. We recognize that urban consumers are rethinking traditional car ownership. M is part of the answer." Okay, here's what I don't understand. So I went to the M website, and it was kicking around there and see what was going on. And there is a quote that reads, "One M vehicle will take five private cars off the road, making cities livable again." Okay, Volvo is a car company trying to sell consumers cars.
Right.
Okay. A, why are they doing this? B, aren't they shooting themselves in the foot with this?
You can say that about all the automakers. I had this discussion a year before Mark Fields left Ford. Ford is getting big into mobility services. They want to do all this. How does that make sense for you? And the best explanation you can give me, and I'm not saying it's a good explanation, but the best that Mark could give me at the time, which I don't think is different from what Hackett would give you today, is, oh, well, you know, if you put all these cars into mobility services where they're running 24/7, instead of being traded in every 7 years, they'll have to be traded in every two. That's what I've been told.
Well, they're wrong.
It doesn't make sense.
But that's sort of a different model. I mean, that would be like the taxi Uber model. This sounds like this is a, you know, John, you want a car to go to the opera, so
it's
you
their
want
Maven.
You want a nice sedan.
It's their Maven, it's their Zip car, and here's why they're all doing it. And they're all talking about we're going to become a mobility company. Ford has said that, Volvo has said that, Toyota has said
Daimler
that.
Daimler just announced they're doing a ride-sharing service in California.
Here's why they're all doing it, because they know the big disruption is on their doorstep. And if they don't do it, somebody else is going to do it. And this is an existential threat to the established car companies right now. And they're desperate to make sure that they're part of the game here.
But the irony, to Gary's point, is that if they succeed, Mr. Ford may beat out Mr. Daimler or GM, but it's still shooting himself in the foot.
We're going into a world of fewer cars in the developed world. The developing world is still going to grow greatly. But in the developed world, we're heading into a world where we're going to need millions of fewer cars than we've got right now. Now, what the car companies are banking on is that they're going to get far more revenue per car when it's shared than they do by just selling it to somebody.
And they want to make sure that they control the model as opposed to Uber or Lyft.
So GM has put some numbers to it. It says globally, it earns $30,000 in revenue for every unit that it sells, from cheap little $7,000 Wuling vans to $90,000 Escalades. They make $30,000 in revenue average. They're saying this is going beyond just the shared, autonomous shared. Mm-hmm. They're saying they should be able to make $200,000 to $300,000 in revenue on every unit that they
do. If you're working in
what they'll charge for a ride-sharing service.
Correct. Right.
All right, so let me switch this up a little bit. So, John, you're talking about this great disruption that's coming, and then we're talking here, Paul, about the economics of things, and I want you guys to explain this one to me, that there is a company that makes scooters that has just gotten a huge investment by Uber to the tune of a $335 million funding round was held for this thing. Yeah. Now these, I was thinking that these were like little Vespas. They're not.
Yeah.
They are scooters, like when
with
we were
like
kids.
Motor on it.
So pedals kind of scooter.
So it's got the handlebar that, or the post and the handle.
When I say pedal, you pedal with your foot on
the
ground.
You pedal with your foot, but then
these are electric.
But, yeah, but you got to start it by kicking your foot. So there's two companies in this space. There's Lime Scooters, mm-hmm. and there's Bird, B-I-R-D. Bird is presently valued at $2 billion, okay? Lime also has bicycles. So it's got bicycles, and it has scooters, right?
Lime is big in San Francisco, I believe.
Yeah, I mean,
and if you go there, it's actually creating a bit of a rebellion because there are so many in use. They are everywhere in San Francisco. People walking on the sidewalks literally have to walk around them or trip over them.
But if you read the
propaganda.
Well, no. They explained that when you drive these things, you're not supposed to ride them on the sidewalk. You're supposed to ride them in the street on the curb lane, and it gives you a whole explanation of what you're supposed to do. And then I started looking at the legal aspect of this whole thing. It's like, holy God, you'd never want to run one of these things. But okay, but here's the thing. So Lyft and Uber are buying into this in a big, big way. Okay, who the hell's going to use a scooter?
Go to San Francisco.
But
take
why?
A look.
Why?
Because they're easy to move. You can pick them up. It's even easier than a bicycle. Hey, I don't use them, but I know that if you go to San Francisco, just stand on any corner and watch them go by. There are more of them on the road in many parts of San Francisco than there are bicycles. And San Francisco is a major bicycle market.
Right. And that's where the Lime bicycle can come into
right.
to play here.
It's become the hot, hip thing.
I think we're just going to see all these mobility companies experimenting.
Yeah.
Whatever can work. And as we've talked about on the show before, I think passenger drones are coming in the next decade. So they're going to try every mode of mobility
exactly.
possible.
Exactly. If you look at it, there's about everything but electric rickshaws. And I think even GM has shown a couple of those.
Yeah, I'm just flabbergasted that these things are so highly valued. And, mm-hmm. and you know, so you have companies like Lyft and Uber, which are also developing autonomous technology and continue to, right, are going for these scooters. I mean, it's just insane.
If it can qualify as a tech buy, add three zeros to whatever the valuation is. A $2 billion company anywhere else would be a $2 million company.
Okay, we got right. time for one more thing.
So I thought this was interesting. So there's this company out of Vancouver, Electromechanica, and it mm-hmm. produced its first production
one-seater
called the Solo. And now this is the thing that struck me as being rather interesting. So they had their first one, and their goal is to deliver 5,000 Solos in a year. Okay? Yeah. So here's a company, startup company, that's building this small little vehicle, and they're planning on building 5,000 in a year, which you know. So I won't mention our favorite company to talk about on the show, trying to get to 5,000 units a week.
Yeah.
But here's this company, $5,000. So here's this car. It's another
Elio.
It's an Elio. So then
looks like
I decided.
An Elio with the tail cut off.
So I decided I would look, you know, we haven't heard about Elio for a while.
Right.
Yeah.
Right? So I looked into that, and I didn't realize. So, you know, those commercials you see on TV for Overstock.com,
yeah.
where you can get this stuff? Well, apparently, Overstock.com bought $2.5 million of stock in Elio last April. And at the same time, Elio, now I got to read this because I don't want to miss. So this is back in April. Elio Motors announced today that it expects to launch a security token offering to, among other things, fund production of the LEO vehicle. So basically, LEO Motors is putting out their version of Bitcoin to fund their production. So here's my question. You know, we've been talking about you know, major automakers and disruption and what's going on. So is anybody outside of General Motors, Daimler, Toyota, et cetera, ever going to be able to make cars at volume? Ever?
With today's technology, no. With today's way of making cars, it's
way
horrifically expensive. You know, until we get to the point where we can 3D print a car right here in the studio, the answer is no.
Whatever happened to that company?
Local Motors? They still exist.
Have they actually sold one? They were supposed to by 16.
No. I think it was about this year.
They were talking 16, then 17, then 18. They kept pushing it back.
Yeah, no, I want to say that
They switched their thing to from completely 3D printing vehicles to the Ollie, which we did the show two or three years ago in the LA Auto Show. They're still pursuing that, and there are components of the Ollie, which is a little shuttle bus that we're going to see more and more of as these autonomous vehicles come to be people movers around campuses and things like that. So they're probably in a good spot for that. But so, Paul, what do you think? I mean, do you think a car company can come from nothing and build at some volume besides, you know, 5,000 a year?
Tesla is finding out how difficult it is. And
I'm trying not to mention that name to every show.
The T company is trying to do it, and you have a few others. Faraday just got some funding. We'll see what that means. I think you're going to see a lot of others that are going to experiment right on the periphery, try to pitch themselves as real high tech, and they're going to try to go for incredible valuations, all of these, the scooter company, with very low aspirations, float around and try to figure out what move to make. I think a lot of them are going to dodge. They're going to, I'm a scooter company, give me a $2 million or $2 billion valuation, and then at some point they'll hopefully be cash rich enough that they can go find a niche and start getting volume. 3D printing, new forms of manufacturing. I mean, there's so many changes coming right now that I think a lot of folks are going to stay in the periphery till they can figure out where to strike. Though I don't think many will succeed, I think that they're waiting, and a couple of these players are going to make it. Hmm. A couple.
You guys are both more optimistic than I am. I think when we come back for AutoLine After Hours, July 12th, 2050, we'll still be saying, they're going to change these things?
Yeah. You could be right. Well, and I'm glad you brought up the date again. First concert or first performance of the Rolling Stones.
1962.
And the last day of Tata.
Of the Nano.
Of the Nano. Okay.
Yeah, Tata still around.
Say Tata Nano.
Yeah. Real good. Well, with that, we ought to wrap it up.
All right.
Paul, good having you on the show.
Great to be with you.
It was really good.
Thanks.
Gary, great topics. Good questions. Okay, let's do it again next week.
Why don't we try that?
Okay, real good.
AutoLine After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion. And by Lear, a global leader in automotive seating and electrical systems.
Visit our website, autoline.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday afternoons. Get your daily fix with AutoLine Daily and in-depth analysis and interviews with AutoLine This Week. There's all that and much more at autoline.tv.